Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER and broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Tanya Katsanis, and coming up this week...
If anyone was looking for a big bang, as it were, in terms of an outcome as far as housing affordability out of the budget is concerned, then they're going to be horribly disappointed with what's transpired.
Harsh words from John Flavelle, CEO of Mortgage Choice. We'll find out why he's underwhelmed about the budget's efforts in improving housing affordability. Also, we'll be catching up with Peter Strong, CEO of Small Business Council of Australia, for his take on the budget and what it means for small business. All this and more coming up on The Money. Over the weekend, Gerry Harvey, co-founder of retailer Harvey Norman, says that any connection between the Australian retail scene and the recession is fake news. The reality, he claims, is the total opposite, and it's a good market at the moment. So the question becomes, is it really a good market for Gerry Harvey, or is he bluffing to gain customers back in the wake of Amazon's arrival? Hans Lee spoke to Brian Walker of Retail Doctor Group about those comments. He started off by asking where Gerry Harvey's optimism was coming from, given that a 1% fall in retail sales happened in March.
What Gerry's talking about is Harvey Norman results, which continue to grow, and somewhat on the back of being very good, astute retailers. The home and housing booms, particularly in Sydney and in Melbourne in particular, where we're seeing strong double-digit growth in demand. It's no surprise to see the growth of Bunnings through this last 3 years. So like all gross aggregate numbers, we have to look into the detail. There's no doubt that fashion has done it tough. There's no doubt that some especially retail has struggled relative to previous years. But on the other side of the coin, food and hospitality is doing very well as well. So they're all showing good growth. The challenge is more in the discretionary retail spend. So I think you'll see that Gerry speaks with authority when it comes to home renovation and the products that Harvey Norman sell.
And on that line there about fashion companies not doing particularly well, but food doing well, do you think that's demonstrating the effect of these online and foreign companies, particularly in the last year, being a big factor in this result?
Australian retail is over $300 billion in sales and revenue. Currently, online is approximately $2.5 to $2.6 billion, 7 to 8% of that number. So in other words, 92 to 93% on average of Australian retail consumers shop in physical stores. What we see with online is a faster growth rate than physical stores. The growth rate for physical stores is somewhere on average between 2 to 3%. Online's about 12 to 15%, again on average. So there is substance to say that online plays a part, but the great role of online is very much about it's a huge research tool. We know through our insights work that over 85% of Australian consumers go online or use their smartphone in some way, shape or form, directly or indirectly, to research the products they're looking to buy. What it also says to Australian retail, as it's saying to retail around the world, is that the physical shop environment needs to be more heightened, more experiential, more value add to consumers. We currently have 39 of the world's top 250 retailers in this country. So half of those come out of the US. There's no doubt that they're taking part of that share. And we've seen some very successful offshore retailers come to our country. The likes of Topshop, of course, Costco, Aldi is a standout example, H&M, Uniqlo, and initially Zara. But they all do tend to come back to earth a little bit after, you know, a successful opening period. So they're playing a part, but not as significant in the overall retail sector.
I want to address on that experiential point of view. Do you think that's what's keeping people like Gerry Harvey optimistic about, you know, setting up ground stores rather than constantly investing in online, which is where the trend is going, even though it's only 8% by a raw number?
We talk about omni-channel retail. So the retailers that are breaking new ground are the ones that have good, strong, captivating physical offer, very high on relationship, very high on selling skills, and very high on differentiated product, supported by a vibrant online trading site, and then have a network around that with social media, community, and building the databases. So one of the strategic positions for retailers is to increasingly build their communities, their tribes, if you like. These loyalists are the people who engage with the organisation. Increasingly tend to visit the retailer online, in stores, and be part of their social media community. So building of that database is very important. The idea that a retailer closes its doors at 5 p.m. and reopens at 9 a.m. is now history. Retailers that trade 24/7 to anyone in the world are the ones that are breaking this ground and doing better business.
Well, I want to draw on that point there. Retail results in general, I just have something from UBS of recent late. They have noticed that there is an inconsistent relationship between quarters of retail results particularly, and in particular to deal with real consumption. Do you think a comment like that would help keep Gerry Harvey's word afloat, as he's put it here?
Yes, I think it does contribute. I mean, when Gerry speaks about retail recession, he's talking about very dominant periods of growth. The report from UBS, as I interpret it, is talking about these spikes of growth, and it's very consistent with what Gerry's been saying.
As the retail doctor yourself, are you, as Brian Walker, worried about the current retail landscape, and what are you guys doing in advising businesses about it?
Well, I'm an optimist and a pragmatist, so I'm not worried per se. I am focusing...
Not even about Amazon coming to Australia?
Amazon, if I talk about Amazon, then they're a $144 billion global business. I often think of them as a huge data operator across all the channels from Prime to Go and so forth. It's wonderful in this omni-channel space, and it's all about ultimately predicting customers' moves, having the database of, really predicting what we know, what we want, pretty well before we know. And I think that's one of their great strengths. Look, there's no doubt, and the other industry analysts are saying it, they could take, depending on the sector, somewhere on average between 4% to 5% of overall retail. But Australia is a different market in the sense that we have very large geographical areas. We're not as closely consolidated as the US. We see Amazon, they're making headway, but it's not as easy, and it takes quite a few years to grow. So many retail operations operate very successfully alongside Amazon. We have to be careful with the intake, the coming in, if you like, of Amazon, that we're able to deal with the substance, because there's a lot of speculation about how they will decimate Australian retail. I don't believe that. And Gerry Harvey doesn't believe that as well. He might not welcome them, but he's certainly pragmatic enough to know that they will take some part of the pie, but not as much as speculated. We talk very much about concentrating on your uniqueness of offer, your differentiation, concentrate on building a database, building your community and your tribe, have a brand with differentiated offering, and then be very, very good consistently at the basics. So retailers, we advise, create pre-shop experience, in other words, communicating strongly with their brand and their point of difference before I even come to the shop, maximizing that experience in the shop, driving the numbers at a detailed metrics level, being very operationally strong, but then having a post-sale communication back to that client so that they're motivated to stay within the group. So where I don't entirely agree with Mr. Harvey, with great respect to him, is that retailers are not particularly susceptible to falls in consumer sentiment. I think there is an elasticity there. I think there is a reaction.
Brian Walker, CEO of Retail Doctor Group, ending that report there by Hans Lee. You're listening to On the Money, where we're breaking down all the questions you have about business and money. We're broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. I'm Tanya Katsanis. Now, with house prices in capital cities at record highs, locking first home buyers out, there was some anticipation in the lead-up to the budget that reforms would be made to ease the pressure. It was announced that there would be new savings options for first-home buyers and incentives for states to unlock supply, which some say just don't go far enough. Roderick Chambers spoke with John Flavelle, CEO of Mortgage Choice, about what he thinks of those changes.
Disappointingly, I don't think that there's going to be anything that's going to have a major impact in terms of housing affordability at all. There were nine measures in the budget that were supposed to cumulatively develop a positive outcome in terms of housing affordability. Three of them were on the supply side of things. And if you look at those, then net-net, our view is that it doesn't actually ease supply at all and maybe create some pressure in certain spots. And then there were six elements that were supposed to deal to the demand side of things. And of the six, I think three, perversely, might actually drive demand up. So if anyone was looking for a big bang, as it were, in terms of an outcome as far as housing affordability out of the budget's concerned, then they're going to be horribly disappointed with what's transpired.
And what do you think is going to drive demand up?
Yeah, so in some instances, if you have a look, I think, at the initiative in relation to providing additional concessions for investors in affordable housing, then that, on the outset makes some sense. But to turn around and offer, deeper concessions from a tax perspective, so a 60% concession as opposed to 50% on capital gains, is only going to perversely drive up the investor demand, which actually puts pressure in relation to the pricing there. So no huge solutions there. As far as a big part of demand across the market, then we're seeing you've got something about 10% of all new dwellings are being purchased by overseas residents, and about 8.5% or 9% of all dwellings are being purchased by overseas residents. And so the changes there in the budget in terms of trying to dampen that demand, so restricting the proportion of new developments that in overseas buyers can take down to 50% only, and placing a tax impost on properties that are left vacant, and increasing the actual level of capital gains tax payable on those properties. They add up to something, but they certainly don't add up to a whole lot. And I don't think that that's going to do much to sate the demand, where you've got, some very strong drivers on a global scale that are pushing people to our shores in such numbers. So I don't think they've gone nearly far enough. And then if you have a look at endeavouring to enable first home buyers to save for a deposit, the measures that have been put in place with the First Home Buyers Super Saver program, if you have a look, not hugely different to the First Home Saver program that was spectacularly unsuccessful. That was introduced by the Rudd government. It was shut down in 2014. And against the backdrop of, expectations of hundreds of thousands of people taking those accounts out, only 12,000 people did. So this scheme's a little bit better. It doesn't go nearly far enough. It only enables a couple to save $60,000 in that concessional environment, which is maybe enough to cover the stamp duty in Melbourne or Sydney. And there's a whole lot of complexity in relation to tying your money up, potentially, if you're not using it for property purchase, until you're 65. So not expecting that to be, as I said, any fundamentally different from the unsuccessful scheme that it replaced that was cancelled in 2014.
But it wasn't about paying for stamp duty. It was designed to give people the opportunity to save up for a deposit, wasn't it?
It is indeed, but stamp duty is a real cost. And if you wanted to make a real and substantive change in terms of driving affordability, then collectively the states get about $50 billion in revenue a year out of property-related tax. 40% of that is actually stamp duty on the transfer of land, so that's $20 billion a year. And there's no argument that that's a significant amount of money, and it's an enormous amount of money for somebody that's trying to get into the market to save for the stamp duty as well as the deposit. But no changes there, and not surprisingly, because of course it's always a case of the revenue pie being cut up between federal and state. Easy to say, hard to actually execute against. But as I said, the First Home Buyer Super Saving Program, I don't expect to be hugely appealing, and I wouldn't expect you to get massive take-up either.
And what do you think about the opportunity for older Australians to downsize and use some of their I guess, released capital value in their homes to put into superannuation. Do you think that's going to have an effect on anything?
Yeah, so long as surveyors should turn around and say, hey, that's not such a bad idea. And now remember, to qualify for that, you need to be 65 years or older and you need to have held the property for a period of 10 years. And you also have to assume that if they realise the sale of that asset and they take $300,000 out, that they're going to have, you know, sufficient funds then to roll into a subsequent property. But it's not a massive part of the market. And if you find that it's wealthy Australians that are actually taking advantage of tax concessions in more affluent and more expensive suburbs, that's not doing a whole lot to release housing stock to middle Australia where it's most desperately needed.
And what do you think about the impost on the big banks? Is that going to affect, are they going to try and put some of these costs onto borrowers?
Yeah, well, I would think that realistically, Scott Morrison would have to be being selectively ignorant or naive at very, very best if he didn't think that in some way, shape or form that ultimately customers and shareholders were going to bear the cost of that. If you have a look, then the tax is expected, or the levy rather, is expected to raise $6.2 billion in revenue over the first 4 years. If you actually look at the impact on the market worth of those five banks in the lead up to the announcement, given that it had been effectively leaked, $14 billion was wiped off the collective market capitalization of those banks. And you know what? Every single person who has got superannuation in Australia, it's mums and dads, it's middle Australia, it's superannuants that are actually invested in those banks. And we all got a haircut, probably somewhere in the order of 0.75 to maybe 1% on our superannuation balances. So we've already paid 2.5 times for it in terms of the worth of our superannuation holdings. And then on an ongoing basis, then of course it's going to be our shareholders in the form of reduced dividends and consumers in terms of both depositors and borrowers that are going to be paying that. And if you think that you can actually, you know, regulate or legislate against that, then as I said, you're being selectively ignorant or at very, very best naive. And I don't think Morrison's actually either of those things, to tell you the truth.
John Flavelle, CEO of Mortgage Choice, speaking to Roderick Chambers. I'm Tanya Katsanis, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network.
Business, that's why they call business sucks. Ooh, it's business. It's business time.
Yeah. Well, small business was a big focus in this year's budget. Importantly, the $20,000 instant write-off was extended for an additional financial year. The government also boasted about the cuts to the corporate tax rate and $300 million in incentives to states to cut red tape that impact on small business. For more, I'm now joined live on the phone by Peter Strong, CEO of the Small Business Council of Australia. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
Nice to have you back.
Yeah, thank you. We were happy with the budget. Let me say, the traditional thing to do with budgets is to criticise it. Unless you got something fantastic out of it, it's to criticise it. Now, my board and a lot of my members said it's actually a fine budget. I mean, nobody ever gets everything they want, but there's a lot of thought gone into it. It's responded to the modern needs of the normal person out there who's a bit sick of hearing about globalisation and a bit sick of the ideologies that you get of laissez-faire economics or whatever. And this was a budget that harked back to the Menzies era. People call it light, or Labor light. I think it was more closer to what Menzies might have done.
So what do you think, Peter, what do you think is the biggest win for small business coming out of this budget?
Well, it's the continuation of, I mean, there wasn't anything new, but it was a continuation of the instant tax write-offs. That's a very handy thing. Businesses out there like it. They use it. So that was what we were happy with. The other area is the extension of a definition of a small business to 10 million. So again, we were happy with that. The other area is all the infrastructure that they're putting into place. So they're doing a lot of infrastructure work out there, and that's done properly. That's always good for the small businesses. They're putting the Inland Railway in, of course. They've got a lot of highways and infrastructure being built around the country. So if they manage it properly and small business get their share of it, then that's a good thing for the businesses out there as well.
So do you think from a perspective of confidence for small business as well as the economy in general, do you think there'll be a flow on to employment opportunities?
Well, with the instant tax write-off, that's our belief. Increasing the threshold for definition of a small business from 2 million turnover to 10 million turnover picks up about another 100,000 businesses, which mightn't seem a lot to some people, but every one of those businesses is an employer. Every one of them wants to grow. That's the nature of those sorts of businesses. And they will get the tax cut, which means they're going to have some extra money to use for investment. If they put those tax cuts out as dividends, well, that's taxed extra again, so there's no benefit from that. So they'll have some money to invest and they'll have the instant tax write-off to use for that purpose. So that, even if half of them put on one person, that's 50,000 jobs. Now, that's not to be sneezed at. That's new jobs that come out of it. I think it'll be more than that. The other thing is we often talk about the casualisation of the workforce. So this is also an opportunity where you might see part-time become full-time, casual become permanent, as well as people being put on. So they're the sorts of outcomes that we expect to see there, especially with the infrastructure as well.
Now, in terms of, we talked about, you know, potential employment, but quite often if a small business doesn't have the work, the tax cut might benefit them but might not create additional work.
Well, that's what I was saying. If they use the instant tax write-off, which we believe they will, then you will see extra jobs come out of it because the instant tax write-off will be used to purchase new equipment, or start a marketing campaign, perhaps expand, buy new equipment for manufacturing, and they create jobs. So that's what we're expecting to see, is that as a result of people getting access to these instant tax write-offs, you'll see more jobs.
Now, also, the big banks were imposed with the levy. Do you think small business owners would be concerned about having those costs passed on to them?
A lot of people will be concerned about it because that's where the media is talking about it. But let me say, it's only the big banks. I mean, time will tell. Time will tell. It's the big banks that have this and the small banks don't. And we've seen that with the reaction to the comments from Anna Bligh and the Australian Bankers Association. The big banks are not happy about it, but the small banks who aren't impacted by this are very happy about it because what it means is they can offer new, cheaper products to people in the community. So their credit cards can be cheaper than the credit cards offered by the big banks. So all of a sudden, the theory is we will see more competition as a result of it. So time will tell, but that was the aim of it. And when you think about it, if a credit card and loans are cheaper with a smaller bank, well, some people will, of course, head to that smaller bank.
Now, are there any other reforms or measures on competition policy that you think could be improved in your view?
Well, they've got to pass the effects test, and that will pass. That's just a matter of going through the process. It would quite stun everybody if it didn't go through. So that should go through fairly soon. We're seeing the impact of the changes in the last 2 years around contract law, where small business people are getting the same protections as the normal person gets. So we're seeing some of that come into play as all of a sudden in franchising and in leasing, we're seeing that the unfair contract terms are not allowed to be applied anymore. And all of a sudden we're getting some fairness in that area. That means that there will be more businesses out there able to expand, they will have more money and more opportunity to grow as well. So that's something that we'll watch and just see how it goes, but we're fully expecting to see some good news out of that.
Now, in terms of startups, they are a significant part of the small business sector. Do they have, do you think, different needs or priorities from an existing business?
Yeah, in startups, there's a couple of things there. There's the psychology of startups. If you've got a young person going into a business and they're around 20 or 25, they probably haven't got a lot of money and they don't care. What they're doing is putting their intellectual property, but they're also putting their energy and belief into it. And they act differently than the older people who put their own money in, the money that they might have earned or put their house up as collateral. And they're a bit more wary, as they should be, because there's real money out there that they're putting at risk. So you see, it just depends where those startups are coming from and the behaviour of the different people. But certainly, we need to get the startups supported, and the support will come with money, or the support will come with mentoring. And I certainly know in the training area, the government's put a lot of time and effort into mentoring apprentices so that they stay in their apprenticeship and finish their apprenticeship, and that's a problem at the moment. So they're putting some effort into areas where startups need support. But I think, as always, I think we can put better effort into that area because governments often don't understand how startups behave. And I think what this government's doing, and the opposition's also focusing on this, is saying, OK, how do we get to the startups and how do we work with these people to make what they're doing more sensible and more successful? And as I say, they've got to understand that they're all different. You can't define a startup the same way every time, and that's the lesson that hopefully they'll learn over the next few years.
I certainly hope they do so. Peter Strong, I do thank you for your time.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. That's Peter Strong, CEO of the Council of Small Business of Australia. And that's all we have for you this week on The Money. We hope you'll tune in again next time to find out everything you need to know about money, finance and business. Thanks to producers Roderick Chambers, Vincent Su and Hans Lee. On The Money is produced in the studios of 2SER Sydney and broadcast around Australia for the Community Radio Network. And remember, you can find all our shows and stories on our website, 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. And we're also on SoundCloud. Search for On The Money. We're also on Twitter and Facebook at OnTheMoney2SER. I'm Tanya Katsanis, and we'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Sydney Film Festival is now on sale. There's over 350 screenings of 288 films from 62 countries over 12 days in 10 venues. From the magnificent State Theatre in the city to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick, there's bound to be a film and venue just right for you. It all happens from June 7 to 18, and you can buy your flexi passes or single tickets right now at sff.org.au. Sydney Film Festival, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
On May 27, you may well have to change your plans if you don't want to miss the 2SER Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon. 2SER's celebration of all things Bob will go for 8 hours and feature news, reviews, interviews, the Bob Dylan quiz, and all the Bob songs that fit, starting at 8 p.m. and going through till 4 in the morning. The Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon on 2SER, May 27, from 8 p.m. 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music, and Bob. It's a hard rain's are gonna
fall. By nature, are sharks aggressive?
No, they're not. They're not.
So this is mushrooms growing out of a wasp.
I mean, we're exposed to literally thousands of synthetic chemicals just in our everyday life.
My family is normal. I just think, oh, every family is just three people.
So if we put hair inside bricks, it will be like insulating your home.
Think sustainability. Rethinking the planet as you know it. Sunday mornings at 11 and again on Wednesday night at 6:30 on 2SER 107.3.
Hi there, I'm Jess Clayman from Weekend Breakfast on 2SER. You can catch me every Saturday and Sunday morning 7 to 10. On Weekend Breakfast, we bring you a bunch of amazing stories, ideas and music to help you wash away the weekday blues. That's Weekend Breakfast with me, Jess Clayman, every Saturday and Sunday morning between 7 and 10 a.m. Stories, ideas, music, 2SER 107.3.